So we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, from the 15th chapter, 7th canto, 15th chapter, entitled Instructions for Civilized Human Beings, text number 20 to 27. And that's a lot of text in a short time. But I don't know, is there... Or it's just like that, huh? Yeah. So I'll read by myself. Kamasyam tam hi ksatridbhyam krudasyaitat faludayat jano yate na lubasya jitva buktva diso bhuva. Translation. The strong bodily desires and needs of a person disturbed by hunger or thirst, are certainly satisfied when he eats. Similarly, if one becomes very angry, that anger is satisfied by chastisements and its reaction. But as for greed, even if a greedy person has conquered all the directions of the world or has enjoyed everything in the world, still he will not be satisfied. Purport. In Bhagavad Gita 3:37, it is stated that lust, anger and greed are the causes of the conditioned soul's bondage in this material world. Kamesa krodesa rajaguna samudbhava. When strong lusty desires for sense gratification are unfulfilled, one becomes angry. This anger can be satisfied when one chastises his enemy. But when there is an increase in loba or greed, which is the greatest enemy caused by rajaguna, the mode of passion, how can one advance in Krishna consciousness? If one is very greedy to enhance his Krishna consciousness, this is a great boon. Tatraluliam ekalam mulam. This is the best path available. Om Agyanati Manandasya Yanandana Salakaya Chakshurun Minitam Yena Tasmai Si Guruve Namah Shri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapanantikam Vandeham Si Guru Si Yutapada Kamalam Si Gurun Vaisnavam Scha Si Rupam Sagrajatam Sagana Raghunatam Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Visakam Vitam Scha He Krishna Karuna Sindho Dina Bandho Jagatpate Gopesa Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namastute Tapta Kanchana Gorangi Radhe Vrindavaneswari Visvanusute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vanchakalpa Trubhyacha Sakripa Sanubhyevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaisnavebhyo Namo Namaha Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadada Sri Vasari Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So the chapter is describing the principle of civilized human beings. Scripture is pointing out ahara nidra bhayu maitunam cha dharmena bina pasubhyasa samana. It is explaining that eating, mating, sleeping, defending are the basic activities for human for living beings, including human beings. And then it is stated dharmena hina pasubhyasa samana, that without following principles of Dharma, one is equal to an animal. So basically, Dharma is governing principles of eating, mating, sleeping, and defending. These areas are all prescribed according to scriptural injunctions. And in this way, Dharma governs the way we express our material activities. The aim of such activity is to become purified, and ultimately it is stated that all activities of Dharma, ata pumbi dvijja svistra shesta vanashram vibhaga sa sanustitasya dharmasya sansidir haritosanam, that we may engage according to our own nature. And according to our natures, we may find a position in the material world where we can find peace of mind and engage our senses according to our propensities. But it must be connected to the Supreme Personality of Godhead if we want to really be successful in spiritual life. In regards to rising above the bodily platform and the pushings of the mind and the senses, there are two attempts that can be made. One is through the mode of goodness, and the other one is through pure transcendental activity. And both of these are going hand in hand, at least in the initial stages in devotional service. And then in the more advanced stages, one can rise above the mode of goodness to the pure transcendental platform. Just like the example of politeness. Politeness is a form of, in a sense, it is a form of hypocrisy. Because people come and you say, "Oh, welcome, do come in." Whereas if you would get spontaneously, you might say, "Oh God, you know, why did you just show up now?" Right? But being polite, we learn to say the right things. Do come in. I hope it's not going to take too long. Have a seat. And there is a prescribed way of speaking. So politeness helps in society. It avoids wars and other difficulties in life. But it has an element of hypocrisy in it. Something false. Something false. It's not exactly always revealing the heart, and we see that. We see all these social hollow phrases that are being exchanged, and that where is the real person behind all this? Yes. So, in Vajna Ashram Dharma, also, there are many external activities of behavior that may not truly represent the condition of the heart. And thus, people behave according to standards of etiquette, right? And in a prescribed role, but not exactly according to revealing their true feelings. And in that way, something is still lacking. Therefore, the position of the mode of goodness is not a position that is a lasting position. Because it's not a completely natural position. One cannot permanently maintain the mode of goodness. We see, yad brahmatam upāryadā, the living beings within the universe are sometimes going upwards to the regions which are in goodness, and sometimes downwards to the lower regions which are in ignorance and passion. In other words, the position of goodness is a temporary position which we can try to attain, and where we have to secure our eternal position, in devotional service. Therefore, Srimad Bhagavatam states, Savai Pumso Paro Dharmo Yato Bhaktira Dokshaje Ahaitikiya Patiyata Yayatma Supersedati. It is only pure devotional service that can really satisfy the soul. And only when the soul is permanently satisfied can we say that we have reached home, param gati, the ultimate destination. Then one can remain fixed in that position. So that is to be understood. Therefore, Varnashram is in a way not our goal. It is a means on the way. But since, as this chapter is called, Instructions for Civilized Human Beings, Srila Rupa Goswami gives some more clarification about civilized human beings, and he points out that most living beings are in the animal species, and then the few that are in the human species, they are unfortunately mostly uncivilized. But those who are following the Vedic injunctions, they are considered to be civilized. He said, but out of those, most are only following lip service. So only acting externally according to the rules, but not really in the heart surrendering. So that puts the history of Europe into the uncivilized tribal regions. And even although we have become modernized, so at best we could be considered as modernized tribals. That's where we are at, just that we sort of appreciate our roots, and obviously that's still deeply rooted. It was, after all, already in the Germanic tribes that the Valhalla, the heaven, the eternal heaven, was a place where there was beer forever. So that's a fact, right? So that's an ancient culture, and that hasn't really changed. So whatever remnants there are within us, that is something we have to face. Vedic culture is a culture of very gradual progress. Srila Prabhupada was oftentimes using the example of a goldsmith who, with a very fine little hammer, is shaping an ornament. He said, that's Vedic culture, a very refined system of purifying its members of society very gradually, little by little, and then trying to bring really a proper shape of conduct and character within a person. Unlike the age of Kali, where such preliminary prerequisites were not fulfilled, and where everyone is totally out of shape. But the Sankirtan movement, Srila Prabhupada compared it to the hammer of a blacksmith, which in one blow, right, just one basic, boff, kind of reshapes anything, right, irregardless of where it's at. And so that's a little bit our process. It's kind of, how shall I say, it's not gradual. It's very revolutionary. It's quite strong. It's drastic, the way that we are undergoing reformation. From one day to the other, you join the Hare Krishna movement, and you remember that verse from Bhagavad Gita, what is day for the materialist, night for the transcendentalist, and what is, and the other way around. Right? It's a change from night to day. I was on a 24-hour jet lag because I was I used to go to bed at 4, and then I was rising at 4. And that's only one example of the transformation. Also, my sadhana was a little different prior to Krishna consciousness. So, in this way, the changes were quite drastic. Quite drastic. And oftentimes, still quite external, not at all really deep down in the heart. One verse in Chaitanya Charitamrita, in the introductory verses of the Mangala Charan, is speaking about Hridaya Kandare Vosachinandana. I like this Hridaya Kandare, the cavities of the heart, or the deep caves within the heart, or as it is translated there, that it is said that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu should be present in the innermost chambers of the heart. And this example I find is very suitable, dealing with the topic of being genuine. Namely, the external chambers of the heart are the public chambers of the heart, the feelings that we share and show, that we speak about, and then the inner chambers of the heart are the hidden ones, the ones that are very private and that are not shared at all. And it is stated that specifically in those innermost chambers, that is where Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu should be present. That's where we should dedicate ourselves to Krishna. And that's the difficulty. Externally, Govindam Adipurusham. Tears are running from my cheeks. So much devotion in the external chambers, but the internal chamber is a little different. Still, the secret sinful thoughts are remaining. And thus, within the civilized human being, there is still, even that civilized human being who's following principles of Dharma, as long as he's a conditioned soul, then within the innermost chamber, there is still an animal. That animal is still there. And that animal wants freedom. That animal wants to break loose. And that animal is looking for opportunities. It wants to be free. What that freedom will lead to, that is quite obvious, considering lust, greed, and anger. So, the thing is not behaving. It's all right, I don't need help. Yeah, I know it. I had one myself before when I was a rock musician. I lived with it day and night, you know. But it's an imitation, it's not the real brand, that's the problem. Sorry. This animal then is to be controlled. So within Varna Ashram, one has to control the lower nature, and there is no question that this is now overcome. Only in pure devotional service, only in pure devotional service can this actually been done. Agam dunvati kartsnenya niharam iva baskara. Only in pure devotional service can this animalistic propensity within our heart truly be conquered. Therefore we are not surprised sometimes when we see that some devotees at time get into difficulties and engage in abominable activity, and we are not surprised because we know well that within our hearts also that same animalistic propensity is there, and it may be covered with a beautiful layer of veneer, of culture, of knowledge, of wisdom, of scriptural quotes and behavior, of dress, and of all the right intricate gestures, smiles, and expressions on the face, and the whole dramatic performance that goes with acting out the role of a pure devotee. But the truth of the matter is, we are not yet there. Doesn't matter. So in that way, we are we're appreciating that it is a process which will take time. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada was able to deal with the Western world. He was able to deal with the Western world, although he came from a quite an exalted background and a culture which was by no means so degraded. Devotees presented to Srila Prabhupada some Freudian ideas, and one of the points that was presented to him was the point of the Oedipus complex, that every man ultimately desires to have sex with his mother. So that is what Freud said. You should, a college student, be aware of these things. So that was the situation. And so someone presented this to Srila Prabhupada and said, this is a widespread phenomena. That's how they presented it. And Srila Prabhupada said, it may be widespread, and this desire may live in the life of many, and it says it may also affect you, he said, but I never had these desires, he said. So Srila Prabhupada came from a very exalted background and a pure culture where he had taken birth, and purity was already there within his heart to some degree. But he had, unlike many others from that culture, he had no difficulty to understand the nature of people from a more fallen background. He could relate to that. He had no difficulty with that. Because Prabhupada could understand that unless and until one finds complete refuge at the lotus feet of Krishna, there is no question of being safe from sinful activity. Sinful inclination may always re-emerge from the heart of one who is not 100% surrendered to Krishna. It is as simple as that. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada could deal with anyone and everyone, because he was not in illusion about people. He was not, and therefore he was not surprised to see sinful behavior, but he was ready to deal with it and to correct it. And when one devotee complained and said that, I'm struggling so much with my mind, because time and time again the memories are coming of all my previous sinful activities. And I don't know why these thoughts are coming back. I really try to act on a pure platform, and all these impure thoughts are just coming back, and I really don't know what to do. And Prabhupada said, these impure thoughts are coming back to remind you that you should never do these things again. And that is, of course, not how we take it. When such impure thoughts reappear, then we think, oh, well, maybe I didn't really know then. Maybe because I wasn't so experienced, maybe I didn't really know then how to enjoy the senses. But now I have a lot more knowledge. Maybe now I know how to do it in a much better way. These kind of thoughts are the product of the illusory energy that may plague a devotee. They may plague us, even on the spiritual path. And these kind of thoughts are just rubbish. This is just total maya, because there is no question that it will ever work in the material world. Sense gratification is doomed, basically. And anyone who is aspiring for it is doomed along with that activity. That's how it is. That is material life. So material life, it is not possible to attain happiness there. That is an important principle of transcendental knowledge, and that we should remember. Meanwhile, we are experiencing that we just cannot always be on the transcendental platform of Sat Chit Anand, always blissful, always remembering Krishna, and totally fixed on the spiritual world. No, at times we start hankering for some pleasure here and now. So then Dharma comes in and says, yes, that's all right. There is a dharmic way to satisfy that desire. There is a civilized way of expressing that desire. Thus, there are ashrams. Thus, get married if you so desire. If you really desire it, go ahead. But all within boundaries. Everything within boundaries. So, this is culture. Culture gives us simultaneously two options. One is, it gives us a means to cultivate a higher state of consciousness by regulated activity. And the other thing it does, it gives us safe boundaries within which we can express our desires. These two means are there within the culture of Vajna Ashram and the culture of Dharma. And basically that's what this chapter deals with. And then it gives us some principles. It tells us one must conquer the modes of passion and ignorance by developing the mode of goodness. So conquer means a fight. That's a fight. And then one comes to the mode of goodness, and then one gradually has to rise to the platform of Sudasattva. So one has to see the mode of goodness is a step in between. It's simply a step in between. So one has to, once one has reached the mode of goodness, given up activities of mode of passion and ignorance and acts according to prescribed duty in the scripture, and always fulfills one's desire in an authorized way, and otherwise one will just deny it. Right? The verse, in the second half of this verse, it says, all this can be automatically done if one engages in the service of the spiritual master with faith and devotion. That is a fact. The spiritual master's objective is to engage us in pure transcendental activity. But nonetheless, a spiritual master is also employing both these standards, the standard of the mode of goodness and the standard of transcendence, and is instructing us also in both ways. Sometimes he will give us an instruction that will help us to become more fixed in the mode of goodness, so that there will be a basis, a better basis for engaging in devotional service. Because it's not that the spiritual master can give us pure transcendental instruction only. It will just be experienced as not practical. His instructions are not practical. I don't know what to do with them. It's all very nice. He gives these amazing lectures, but I don't know what to do with them in my everyday life. And then you get this dichotomy between what we know and what we are experiencing in everyday life. So the first and foremost duty of an acharya or a spiritual master is to bridge the gap between a person's natural condition and behavior to the standards of the scriptures, and step by step bridge that gap to the point where someone is nicely situated in scriptural behavior. That is required. And then, but meanwhile, even if there's no scriptural behavior, devotional service is always possible. That we saw in Jayananda, who picked up people from the street and said, excuse me, could you help me for one moment, doing some work here? Could you just hold a plank for a moment? Yeah, no problem. Bang, bang, bang. Jayananda was hammering the nails. And then he said to the person, oh, could you just on your side put in a few nails? And then the man put in a few nails. And then Jayananda said, wow, that was really expert. Are you a carpenter? And then before this person knew, they were engaged in building the Rath cart. And then if they wanted to smoke while building the cart, then Jayananda said, no. He said, stop, stop, stop. Go wash your hands. Go wash your mouth. He said, like, you know. And he gave him a whole lecture. This is for Lord Jagannath. You cannot smoke while you're doing this work on the chariot. And then he sent them back on building the chariot. And in this way, with totally new people, he built the chariot. And then he would go quickly up and down in the temple and bring lots of prasadam. He would allow some of his workers a little smoke break, though, you know, outside. But what to do? But eventually, just he showed that devotional service is available for anyone and everyone, irregardless of which mode of material nature they are in. And that even one who is completely in the mode of ignorance can also be engaged, make spiritual advancement, and just through the process of devotional service rise above the lower modes of nature. As is stated in the second chapter of Bhagavatam, Tadara jas tamo bhava kamalobhavaryascaye mataivadi tanvidistitam sattvapasirati. That gradually, by engaging in devotional service, the influence of passion and ignorance will just disappear on its own. So it's not only about conscious endeavor and trying to act in the mode of goodness and very passionately trying to act in goodness. It's very difficult. But simply by engaging in devotional service, stitam sattva pasidati, one gradually becomes firmly fixed, stitam, in the mode of goodness and even in the transcendental mode of goodness, Visuddha Sattva. So that is our aim. There are a few verses that stress that taking shelter of a spiritual master is what can save us, and somehow or other, these instructions must be taken as very sacred, whatever they may be. I just received a nice book about Tamal Krishna Maharaj, like a real big pictorial book with quotes and comments. So I've been looking at it, and it described how Tamal Krishna Maharaj said, the first time I saw Srila Prabhupada, and when I saw his face, he said, I only saw surrender in that face. He said, I just saw surrender in his face. And that touched me very deeply. Well, further in the book comes the confrontation where Tamal Krishna Maharaj at one point had said, when in a discussion with Srila Prabhupada, there was a discussion about changing Tamal Krishna Maharaj's service, and Tamal Krishna Maharaj was at the time heading up the Radha Damodar Sankirtan parties. And when that discussion came up, he became very disturbed that there was a move to move him out of that service. He was attached to it. So it was brought to Prabhupada, and Prabhupada suggested it. And then he said that, I might as well go to China. And then he walked out and he left it at that. And later he came back and the discussion resumed. And Prabhupada said that it was a good idea that he should go to China. And then he said, no, Prabhupada, I was only joking. And Prabhupada said, I didn't think it was joking. I think it was Krishna speaking through you. And then Bhattamal Krishnamurti didn't surrender. He didn't want to go. He still was like not ready to go. And Prabhupada became very angry. And his lips started quivering. And when Prabhupada's lip was quivering, then he was seriously angry. Yeah, very angry. So he saw the lip and he knew what it meant. And he just sort of slowly like going through this inner resistance from like not China, but there was just no way out. And he said, but I'm in charge of Radha Damodar. All these buses and all these devotees are depending on me. I'm in charge of it. And Prabhupada said, I'm taking it away from you right now. Now you have nothing. Now you have nothing. Now I have nothing. And then finally, all right. And then he finally accepted it, China, and then got into it, the whole thing. So that was like a heavy moment where Prabhupada was really demanding, where Prabhupada was not at all looking at what is your varna, what is your ashram, what is your inclination, and are you really comfortable with the service that I'm suggesting, and do you think that you can psychologically deal with the possible traumas that may arise from this service, and, you know, I mean, do you feel you have an adequate support structure to deal with this instruction? And do you really think that you can digest it, my dear disciple? Flower, flower, flower. Well, Guru Maharaj, I think I really have some difficulties with it. Oh, then it's all right. No. Then I... then what would you like? the psychological age of the new millennium in which we have now reached. So Srila Prabhupada was not always employing these tactics, right? And sometimes, especially with his more intimate man, he wasn't pussyfooting, so to speak, right? Straight, you know, China, yeah? There off you go. A continent. Right? And that meant one man in charge of China. Good luck. So, of course, Srila Prabhupada himself had such extraordinary surrender and devotion that he could instill such faith in people. And on the strength of that faith, big orders could be given. And if the spiritual master cannot generate that much faith, he can also not give such a tall order. A spiritual master has to see how much faith can I actually generate in my disciple, and accordingly he can order. Because if he gives it, he gives an order and he knows that the disciple cannot follow it, what's the point? There will only be offenses, reactions, and so on. But sometimes the risk must be taken for the sake of the Sankirtan movement. And sometimes an order must be given, which is a risk, which may not be followed. Sometimes sannyas was given to young men, very young. It's like, how could he give sannyas to such young men? But he did. But they fell down, and anybody would have thought they can't maintain. And Prabhupada said, for an emergency, it had to be done. He said, we needed some sannyasis to push on this movement. I had to take the risk. So, yeah, but what about these men? Were they sacrificed? No, even when they failed, there was still Prabhupada's special prayer. So somehow or other, even then, they didn't lose his protection. but it was necessary. So our movement is a combination of both instructions of Dharma and pure transcendental instructions. And really, in the days of Srila Prabhupada, the stress was on the transcendental side. Absolutely. And then followed by Varnashram. Of course, he did say at the end of his life that Varnashram was still something that had to be introduced, and that in that sense his mission was not completed. So we can fill it in. We can fill it in. How to actually live according to prescribed duty. We can create a culture now. A culture of ashrams. In each ashram. And then even varnas. Although we see that in the Vaishnav community, varnas seem to have less importance than ashram. We're seeing that ashram is very fixed. Right? In one day, well, you can change your varna. In the morning, you can be a pujari. Right? Then later in the day, you can clean the castle and be a sudra, a sweeper. In the afternoon, you can go out and sell things, or you can work in the shop and be a vaishya. And, you know, when some unwanted visitor comes, you can use your old jujitsu training and show them the door. And in this way, in one day, one can go through four varnas. You cannot in one day go through four ashrams. That would be a bit extreme. Brahmachari in the morning, grihasta at noon, sannyas at lunch, and well, then what, you know? I wonder what the evening's going to bring. Yeah? But the evenings, you could possibly have more fun in another ashram than the sannyas ashram. Anyway, so we don't change all the ashrams in one day. So varna ashram, we use it. It is a support structure. We do not have full identification with the varna ashram. In my days of management in Mayapur, our GBC for a while was Harikesh Maharaj at the time. And he had put a lot of thought into varna ashram. And he came up with a concept which was quite interesting. Namely that he started to divide up the departments in the temple according to varna ashram. And he said there are departments which are brahminical departments, there are kshatriya departments, vaishya departments, and sudra departments. And then, well, he started to fix the relationships between the departments on these principles. So the vaishya departments, they had to be charitable, and they had to give money to the brahminical departments. Right? That was the system. And money could never be taken from a brahminical department. It was an interesting approach to varna ashram, and it sort of helped to bring structure into a huge project with so much diversity and competition from so many departments and many wars and so on. And it brought peace in the community. And from that, we understood a principle that within the Vaishnav community, the work is more assigned to a particular varna, not so much the person. The person, while he is engaged in a particular work, may act in a particular role accordingly, but internally, he's on the Vaishnav platform, always. So it's the work that gets the identity. Anyway, so whether civilized, whether not civilized, let us somehow or other embrace devotional service. Because the more we embrace the process of devotional service, that will be our saving grace. then to stay in devotional service, a bit of Varna Ashram will help. But let's put the emphasis on devotional service. I'll end. Yes, O Manohar. Bold instructions are diminishing.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, what would you like? Well, I do think that looking at the history of ISKCON in the Dzogchen Lhartscharya era, whatever it may have been, didn't have a happy end, because many of those leaders got personal difficulties, and it brought the faith in ISKCON to an all-time low, and it never recovered. Prior to that crisis, faith was quite high. Faith in the leaders, faith in Prabhupada, and faith in Prabhupada's instructions was so high. So even if a leader was not behaving proper, in those days, still one would uphold the principles of Srila Prabhupada's instructions. In the days of yonder, if a devotee was in disagreement with the leadership, he would leave ISKCON. He would possibly even speak strong words of disagreement, but he would never go to a court of law. Right? That was unthinkable. That you couldn't do. That was like going against Krishna. That was like, dooming your own spiritual life. No devotee ever moved the court on ISKCON or any other devotee. But the times changed. And now the court is an option. Oh, yes, it is. So lack of faith has changed so many things. Devotees, when they joined, they would give everything. And if you weren't voluntarily, then, there were ways. When I I first joined in Vrindavan, stayed for a short time, then I became ill, and therefore I stayed outside with hepatitis for 5 months, then I came back to the temple. When I came back, then they immediately asked me, what did you do before Krishna consciousness? Did you have any hobbies? And they sort of like interviewed me to find out all my possessions, and then we sort of took notes and guitar. All right, what kind of? Okay, any amplifiers? Recording equipment. Everything was there, and then at the end, he said, "All right, let's go and pick it all up." And then the van would go and collect everything. That's what happened in my case. But the mood was that devotees would just give everything. Now that's, Ridai gave his car, his BMW. Yeah. He did. Wasn't a new one, but still, So, those were different times. Now, if you speak to a new devotee about giving his BMW, he says, "Speak to my lawyer." Yeah? That's the first thing. So, all symptoms of the great breakdown of faith. It's not exaggerated to speak about the great breakdown of faith. And now, when you're a spiritual master, you have less authority than the temple commander used to have in the 80s. You know what I mean? Whatever the temple commander said, that would go. And nowadays, even as a spiritual master, you know, your word is not absolute anymore. Even now, as a spiritual master, you have to negotiate due to lack of faith. And people think that that lack of faith is justified, because they think that no one is, first of all, no one is as qualified as Srila Prabhupada. Yes. And now we know the truth. And most gurus are at best madhyam adhikaris, and so on. Yeah? And that has become like quite a common outlook, yeah, which is not necessarily true. But this is the situation. We're having like a general mentality, which is seeing people possibly at a lower level than they are. So we start with a handicap these days. Therefore, there is a reason to be a little careful and not be too demanding and just say, go, I want you to preach on the moon to just anyone and everyone. Because, you know, they may say, like, you know, this is too much, you know, and Prabhupada would have never given an instruction like this. Where is the example that he ever sent a disciple to the moon? So like that, yeah. It is tough, but I think we should not be afraid, you know. We can pamper everyone and get a movement of dysfunctional, overly dependent people, right, who are very weak and shaky, or we can just take a little bit of a risk and have some demands, and get some people who have some strength, and who can stand on their own feet, and do something for Lord Chaitanya's movement, and then attract a few people like themselves. Birds of a feather flock together. If we get all the basket cases, then we can expect that we'll get more basket cases. So a little boldness at time is in its place, and you know, whenever you need a bold statement, give me a call. I'm always ready. You know, it's sort of with pleasure. As far as I'm concerned, Varna Ashram is one of the most boring topics that we have in ISKCON. And the thing is, you know, as soon as you open your mouth about Varna Ashram, everybody has an opinion about it, and everyone has a different opinion, and everyone has a realization, and they feel very strong about it, and they always have to say it. And you know, there are people who like speaking about the holy mission of Varna Ashram, and I offer them my respects, but I beg to differ. I think that Varna Ashram is of a secondary nature. We can, of course, produce many quotes in the Nectar of Devotion from Srila Rupa Goswami, where repeatedly Varna Ashram is rejected. And I think it's a support structure. I have prepared it, compared it to crutches. That if a person has a broken leg, then he has to walk on crutches. But once the plaster is gone, you know, then one day, throw him away. Yeah? So, as far as I'm concerned, Varna and Ashram. Two crutches. So, let us all hobble along, right, in our Varna Ashram. But the real matter of the heart, the real matter is the condition of the heart. It has to be 100% pure. Not that the innermost chambers remain full of sinful desires and we're nicely walking along with the regulative principles of Varna Ashram. No, that's not good enough. It really has to be. We have to become saintly. We have to become saintly. That is the purpose. So, it's nice. I'm also taking shelter of Varna Ashram. My danda is part of it, but it's not the all in all. Service is more important.
Divine Ashram. It's I don't know why it's so popular. Yeah, personally, I don't like it. Lectures on Varnashram are not my favorite, and therefore I always have to say something in protest, as I did again today. And I hope that I'll get some emails from people who are upset by it. So, if somebody wants to take the trouble and transcribe this statement, they can post it on the web and Facebook, and let's see what comes back. I once, here in Radhadesh, also gave a lecture on Varna Ashram, and actually it was here that for the first time I compared it to crutches, and the next day I had something like 175 emails, even from Timisoara, a place where I've never been. So let's see what's going to happen now. I'm looking forward. But I'm not going to answer those emails. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.